It's my pleasure to welcome our special guests, CDC Director Tom Frieden and HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, to the 44th National Immunization Conference. For me, this meeting is like a big family reunion, and today's opening session is like that special dinner party where you get your favorite people to come, and so I am just really, really excited. But we're gonna tell you what to expect in this program. I'm gonna introduce Dr. Frieden, and then Dr. Frieden is going to introduce Secretary Sebelius. She will give her speech, and then the two of them are gonna have to leave at that point. But we'll still go on, and I'll give my annual update. We'll have the annual award ceremony for all of our winners up here, and then I'm gonna end with, if there's time, with my annual poem. Okay, so everyone in this audience knows the CDC's new director, Tom Frieden. You know that he's been saving lives and rabble-rousing from the streets of New York City to the rural villages of India. You know that he's been a fearless crusader for the public's health, bringing innovation and accountability to areas as diverse as tobacco, food labeling, TB control, and electronic health records. But what you may not know about Dr. Frieden is just how intensively he was managing CDC's H1N1 response, intimately involved in the complex day-to-day strategy, asking an inordinate number of questions, and on multiple occasions, frankly, saving us from making some not-so-good decisions. Tom is known for his focus on results, but what you may not know is just how passionate and protective he is about the nation's public health system. And throughout this past year, he has truly had our back. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Frieden.
Thank you very much, Anne. It's a pleasure and an honor to work with you and the terrific staff, not just here at CDC, but around the country, who are so many people who were behind the fact that immunization was one of the great accomplishments in public health in the 20th century. I think our challenge is to ensure that it becomes also or remains one of the great accomplishments of public health in the 21st century, both globally and in this country. And we have enormous challenges with new vaccines, with global challenges, with economic and health structure issues, and enormous opportunities with health reform in the United States. It's my honor to introduce Secretary Sebelius. Kathleen Sebelius is the 21st Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, and we're very fortunate to have her at the helm. She has experience not only as one of America's top governors, but also as state insurance commissioner, and understands the challenges and opportunities that health insurance and health insurance reform bring. Today isn't just about the one-year anniversary from the emergence of H1N1, but it's also about the one-year anniversary of Secretary Sebelius's tenure. She came in thinking that health reform would rapidly pass and there would be no such thing as H1N1 influenza. Reality has a way of interfering with the best laid plans. She brought the department together for both of those efforts. She's a strong believer and supporter in public health. She's strategic and focused. In her time as governor of Kansas, she strengthened childhood immunization as well as access to health care and helped bring health coverage to more children. She was named by Time magazine one of the top five governors of the U.S. as a smart manager. And as HHS secretary, she works to ensure that health care is available for all Americans, leading one of the largest federal institutions with 80,000 employees. For all of us, H1N1 was an enormous challenge. It also was a way of showing that we can rise to tremendously stressful, complicated, and involved challenges and meet them. And Secretary Sebelius was at the helm through all of that. She has enormous responsibilities in the implementation of health reform, one of the most complex and important projects that this country will face in the coming years, and it could not have better stewardship. We're thankful for Secretary Sebelius' leadership as we continue to strengthen immunization efforts and advance public health in new and exciting ways. Secretary Sebelius recognizes that a well-run and well-supported health system is critical for both the health of our citizens and the economic health of our country, and understands that immunization is a key component of effective healthcare delivery. Secretary Sebelius?
Thank you. Good morning. Well, thank you so much to Dr. Frieden and to Dr. Shuckett, who have done an incredible job leading this effort. And I want to say welcome to all of you here at the 44th National Immunization Conference. I assume that most of you weren't here at the beginning of these conferences, but I understand that many of you are lifers and repeating year in and year out, sharing the practices and sharing ideas and information. And there's no question you all are the folks who are on the front lines of the fight against the H1N1 pandemic, as well as the fight to protect Americans through immunization year in and year out. You should be incredibly proud of your efforts, how aggressively and effectively you fought to make sure Americans were safe. And I wanted to take the opportunity to remind you how far we've really come. You all remember April 21st, 2009, which was almost a year ago. And I was still governor of Kansas at the time, to put this into some context. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced on that day that they'd identified a flu strain never seen before and found it in both California and Texas. And preliminary lab results revealed that similar viruses were occurring in Mexico. And at that point, scientists realized we had a serious outbreak on our hands. Now, let me also remind you that Dr. Frieden at the time was the New York Health Commissioner. So we were both in different places beginning to watch this outbreak from different venues. President Obama made it clear from the beginning that the safety and security of the American people were his top priority. And frankly, it was an interesting exercise, I think, from the beginning for a new president to have an outbreak like this and to really experiment with how to bring government together. He directed the entire federal government to mount a comprehensive response to what was then a new and very unknown health threat that would later be declared a pandemic. On April 28th, I was actually sitting in my office in Kansas. We had a plan because that was the day that the Senate was going to take up my nomination and hopefully vote to confirm me. And the plan was that I was going to resign as governor once that confirmation vote came through. We would have a ceremony to swear in the lieutenant governor as the new governor, and I would then go to Washington. About halfway through the day, after the debate in Washington had just started, I got a call saying, there is an airplane in the air coming to get you. We need you to get on that airplane and come to Washington. Whereupon I literally went home, threw some stuff in a bag, went out, got on a plane, having little idea where I was going, kind of by myself. I did say to the pilots, somewhat jokingly but somewhat seriously, so if they don't vote to confirm, do you give me a ride home, or is this a one-way ticket? Because I really was not certain of the outcome at that point. Indeed, about halfway across the country, I got a phone call on the plane saying, you are now the secretary, congratulations. I executed a document again on the plane that matched the document I had left in Kansas, resigning so that my successor could be sworn in, arrived, and was escorted immediately into the Oval Office, was sworn in with the president holding the Bible, and then taken to the Situation Room. And I had to be taken to the Situation Room because I didn't have any idea where the Situation Room was. But already there were lots of national and, on the phone, international health experts gathering to try and assess what we were dealing with and what the growing number of H1N1 cases look like. The Department of Health and Human Services didn't waste any time. We had mobilized the world's top scientists at CDC, the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institutes of Health, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, and began to work closely with other outside groups and other federal agencies. Soon, Dr. Frieden was on the front lines with the H1N1 virus showing up in New York City, which had one of the earliest and frankly deadliest spring outbreaks, and cases began to be evident around the world and eventually in the Southern Hemisphere. The World Health Organization declared a global pandemic, first pandemic, as you know, in 40 years. And well before flu season really began, we had many people, particularly children and young adults, very sick and some actually dying from the flu. So it was time to get the entire country involved. And again, the president made it pretty clear from the outset we needed to strike a balance between panic and complacency, have a sense of urgency so people began to get educated. But again, panic was not going to be very helpful. And you all really stepped up to the plate at that moment, made a rapid assessment of the needs and the capacity of states and in your communities, developed vaccine plans designed to meet those needs. You set up clinics, and as vaccine began to arrive, and that arrival, I don't need to tell you, was a bit erratic and unpredictable, you worked hard to ensure that the clinics had flu mist and shots and ran smoothly, got the word out to families and children and people with chronic diseases, expectant mothers and others in the high-risk population that we knew from the scientists needed to get vaccinated first. You ended up enrolling three times as many healthcare providers to vaccinate people against H1N1 than we had providing vaccinations for the Vaccines for Children Network, an incredible accomplishment in a short period of time. And that meant we had a much more robust system getting vaccine into communities faster and knew that people could be protected sooner. Less than 6 months later, we have now administered about 90 million doses of vaccine. I say we, meaning you, protected about 80 million individuals from H1N1 flu. And combined with 100 million people who got the seasonal flu vaccine, there has been an unprecedented level of immunization during the 2009-2010 flu season. And what's more, when you see someone in the grocery store coughing into their sleeve, or a parent who keeps a child home when he or she is sick, or someone working to disinfect their keyboard, you can take a little credit for that too. I think the public health messages spread during the course of this year have been extraordinary. So on behalf of all of us at the Department of Health and Human Services and on behalf of the President of the United States, I want to start by saying thank you. We are facing a dangerous and unpredictable world, and in that situation, with state budgets under enormous pressures, you came through and made a really incredible difference. We learned a lot from this experience. In a few minutes, Dr. Shuchat is really going to dive into the lessons learned from the H1N1 response, but I wanted to hit a couple of the points very quickly. First, it's very important to plan and prepare. Now, thanks to the preparations, we were able to issue public health emergencies within days of the initial cases. Among other things, the declaration enabled us to distribute a portion of the federal antiviral drug stockpile to states and territories right away, push that out into places where it could be easily accessed and used. We reached out to other governments with our infectious disease experts, built lab capacity and enhanced surveillance so we could also learn from them in places where the disease had progressed further than here at the U.S. And here at home, we made sure our vaccine safety and tracking system was absolutely state-of-the-art, enhanced again over years past. We worked very closely with states to set up a new extensive vaccine distribution system, diversified our manufacturing base, signing up not only one, but five companies that were already producing seasonal flu vaccine to make the new H1N1 vaccine. The president said at the outset, we needed to trust science, and that's exactly what we did. The scientists decided we needed to run more trials on the H1N1 vaccine because even though it was made exactly the same way seasonal flu vaccine was made, we knew we had to have the public's confidence if they were going to indeed get vaccinated. We didn't distribute the vaccine until we knew it was an excellent match to the virus. And again, I think this is one of the untold stories to how absolutely on target this vaccine ended up being to the virus that was presenting around the world. We directed states to follow the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices recommendations and target people in high-risk groups, which directed our efforts and resources to the most vulnerable and helped protect everyone else. Again, a real challenge with a limited supply of vaccine, which we knew we would have from the outset, making sure that people understood who was most at risk and how to actually reach out to that population. We made a commitment to tell the American people from the outset what we knew and when we knew it, and that turned out to be quite a challenge. We launched an aggressive communication strategy to get the word out to the American people, primarily about vaccination, since this is the single safest and most effective way to protect public health, but also knew we would have a corridor. We didn't know how long it would be, but we knew we'd have a corridor between the time that the flu virus presented and was very active and the time that vaccine would be available. So we had to develop a series of public health strategies about what people could do to keep the flu from spreading, the best protocol for coughs and sneezes, how to keep surfaces clean, staying home when children are sick or an adult is sick. And because it was clearly a young person's pandemic, we wanted to make sure and include partners, which appealed to kids. So Elmo got involved from the beginning, and he did a better job of sneezing than Chuck Todd did. We used Facebook and Twitter. We had a hip-hop doctor with his own rap about the flu, strategies that for typical flu season may not have been used, but drilled the message out to kids and young adults about them being the vulnerable population. And we saw how smart it was to frankly depend on you. State and local health departments continued to come up with great ways to make it convenient to get vaccinated and experimented with strategies, frankly, that will be hugely helpful in the future. Drive-by clinics became popular, partnerships with pharmacies, schools that turned gymnasiums and parking lots into vaccine clinics. A recent CDC study found that one out of every three children across the country who got the H1N1 flu vaccine received it at school. And that's an amazing step forward and a lesson learned in those schools that will really help us in the future. We got the business community involved, working overtime to make sure that their employees had some flexibility to stay home when they or their kids were sick, and to ensure that the workplace was as much as possible a flu-free zone. And some held their own vaccination clinics. Hospitals across the country pitched in and made use of all available space. We're grateful to those of you who insisted the doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers get vaccinated. I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but I think that's still a challenge we have moving forward. Doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and others juggled the need to administer separate doses of vaccine, one for seasonal flu and one for H1N1, and additional doses for kids 9 years and under. So a lot of logistical challenges about reaching out to the population. Here was a lesson that came through loud and clear. Some of our most valuable resources for keeping people healthy in this country are our businesses, our community, and our government leaders, as well as school leaders, in addition to the dedicated healthcare providers who are already on the ground doing the work you do so well. And it's a lesson, I think, that applies to much more than the flu. The best and most recent example is the huge step forward we took in health insurance reform. Many of our friends and neighbors still have questions about the law, and that's understandable. Given the complexity and enormity of the healthcare system, it would be surprising if they didn't. And it didn't help that over the course of this discussion in the last year, they were bombarded by nearly $200 million in ads, many of which were frankly intentionally misleading or designed to scare people about the new law. But in reality, the Affordable Care Act will give millions of Americans with insurance more security and stability, and it gives Americans without insurance better insurance options in the future, bringing down costs for families and businesses and government. In addition, it's often an untold story what a huge investment this law is making in public health. This year alone, plans will cover recommended preventive care and immunizations without any cost sharing, wanting to remove the financial barriers to people actually getting preventive care. People with Medicaid will cease to have a cost share for preventive services. Beginning January 1st next year, Medicare will follow. So beneficiaries will no longer pay out of pocket for copays for annual wellness visits or preventive care and screenings. There are tax credits available this year for small business owners so they can afford to cover their employees, and incentives for the first time ever for employers to promote wellness in the workplace. The law puts new resources, and much needed resources, I would say, into state and local health departments for the public health workforce and for evidence-based programs to help Americans approaching retirement age stay healthy and get the right treatment when they need it. It sets up a trust fund dedicated to prevention and public health, which CDC and many of you will have a great input into about what are the strategies we want to continue invest in and take to scale. Contains new funding for childhood obesity demonstration project that was authorized last year as part of the Children's Health Insurance Program but never funded. And it makes new funds available to communities to build bike paths and parks and help fight chronic disease as part of a community transformation grant. The new law makes a big investment in health communication, imposes new food labeling requirements for chain restaurants so customers will actually know how many calories they're eating. Now, this is a page right out of Dr. Frieden's playbook from New York City. When he was health commissioner, they instituted a similar program in New York. But we know, for instance, that most of the kids get their calories outside the home. About 80% of the calories we consume are eaten outside the home. So this kind of change of informing people so they can make better choices is long overdue. It provides resources to educate people of all ages about nutrition, oral health, regular exercise, smoking cessation, just to name a few of the things people need to do to stay healthy. So for the first time, patients and consumers can make better and more informed choices about their own health. And what's going to make these 2010 reforms and ultimately public health in this country even more effective is that we're building on the significant improvements that have already been made in the healthcare system in 2009. A lot of the attention is focused on the bill debate in 2010 and the passage of this law, but I just want to remind you of what happened starting in early 2009 that a lot of people have already overlooked or forgotten about. In the Recovery Act are some of the biggest investments in public health in American history. We have funded proven local health and wellness strategies to give families more healthy choices in their neighborhoods. As you all probably know, the Recovery Act provided $300 million to support the Section 317 immunization program. It also expanded community health centers, which now provide high-quality, lower-cost primary care to 19 million Americans every year in some of our most rural and urban areas. We invested in the National Health Service Corps to strengthen the primary care workforce, especially in underserved areas. Made an historic investment in health information technology, which helps patients fill out fewer forms and doctors deliver better care. Another piece of legislation, again in 2009, was the expansion of the Children's Health Insurance Program, along with the Recovery Act, was one of the first bills that President Obama signed last year. And thanks to this program, by the end of 2009, even with very difficult budget times, an additional 2.6 million children had been enrolled in the CHIP and Medicaid programs, kids who were eligible for the programs, but at that time didn't know that they had the opportunity to enroll. And I'm currently, as I travel around the country, challenging my partners in the federal government and state and local community organizations to find and enroll the estimated 5 million children who are currently eligible but still not signed up. We know that there are interesting strategies, and many of you have probably been on the front lines of those strategies. I was recently at the Children's Hospital in Cincinnati, and they have an embedded county social worker in the hospital who sits in the billing department. About half her salary is paid by the county and half by the hospital. But when a family has a very ill child who is accessing services at the hospital, they have determined that it's enormously helpful for families who don't have insurance coverage to be able to sign up very quickly and easily with a worker right there at the hospital for the services for which they're eligible. It's been a great stream of revenue for the hospital, well overcompensating for the salary funds that they're spending, but it was just an example to me of the kind of strategies that people are beginning to look at and experiment with to make sure that families and kids in hard-to-reach and vulnerable communities understand those benefits are available right now. So I'd like you all to also think about that challenge in clinics and schools and other places where families present but may have children eligible for the programs and for that stream of revenue that can help pay for salaries and costs moving forward. All of this adds up to a more effective, stronger infrastructure in our healthcare system moving forward. We're making a very conscious effort not only to improve access and affordability, but also to follow the evidence-based practices and strengthen community health. If you live in a neighborhood with a food desert, or if you don't have a place to send your kids safely outside to play, it's interesting to hear all the conversation about nutrition and wellness, but it really has very little impact on your family. So addressing the ancillary issues that families are dealing with that really impact the health of themselves and their kids are part of the strategy moving forward. We're taking a pragmatic approach when it comes to implementing health insurance reform, making it easier for seniors to get medicine, easier for families and young adults to get coverage, easier for businesses to cover their workers right away. Many of those strategies happen in 2010. And beginning to lay the foundation for 2014 when the major elements of the new law kick in. It's when health insurance exchanges become operational and tax credits become available for all individuals and families to help purchase health insurance. We're looking for practical lessons to apply for flu seasons moving forward. One of the teachable moments from the past flu season was on the communications front. We wanted to make sure that American people knew what we knew and when we knew it. But frankly, we probably raised expectations too high, relying on numbers given to us early by the drug companies that kept having to be adjusted downward. So we need in the future to be more realistic about that. When the manufacturers told us their estimates, we reported it, but it turned out they were optimistically high and unfortunately set a bar too high. So when the vaccines grew more slowly, we had to revise the projections downward. It wasn't a failure of the system, but may have put people in a situation that was more difficult than necessary to deal with. We firmly believe that states need to manage vaccine distribution, and again, the lessons learned this season was that that was generally very, very helpful. We know that state and local officials are closer to the ground and know where the vulnerable population should be reached, and nobody should sit inside the Beltway in D.C. and try to pick and choose where within a state is the appropriate point of vaccine distribution. But we also, in this experience and in this partnership, identified some very weak links in some state systems. So working on those in the future is one of the challenges we have. We want to use the information that we've gained to highlight and accelerate the best practices to get vaccine to people as quickly as possible. And we need to do a better job of engaging two groups in particular where we turned out to have some serious gaps. One is the minority communities in this country. There continues to be a huge gap in coverage for minority and majority communities. And part of it is that study after study has shown that there is a lingering apprehension about vaccines, particularly in the African American community. There is a lot of belief that vaccines are not safe, that they may not work, that these are experimental, and with so many African Americans, Hispanics, American Indians, and others experiencing higher rates of chronic condition, we know that these populations are much more vulnerable to serious impact from influenza. But we have to do a much better job of outreach and education before we get to the next crisis. So even if vaccine is perceived as dangerous, the education about how much more dangerous the threat of the disease is something that needs to be engaged in a conversation. And we need your help. We need to come up with creative ways to increase the vaccination rates in minority communities. And secondly, with healthcare providers. I don't think we should have to have a battle convincing healthcare providers that first, vaccines are safe, and secondly, that they work. But we saw that battle engaged in too often again this year. Despite the fact that in 2010 we had more healthcare providers than ever getting vaccinated, still a sizable number did not. And the public debate from healthcare providers about whether or not this was an important strategy going forward helped to undermine confidence of a lot of the public. We need providers on the front lines. We may need to make sure that the vulnerable people they work with aren't at greater risk because of the refusal to get vaccinated. So you all are the experts that the rest of us look to when we need good advice about help. We need your help and advice, encouraging patients and the people you work with to protect themselves and the folks around them. And we need to get the word out to the provider community broadly. We need people to get vaccinated. It does little good to make a vaccine that's on target if people actually won't choose to be vaccinated or have their children vaccinated. Finally, the flu season has made us even more committed to ensuring that vaccine production and all of our medical countermeasures are state-of-the-art in the United States. Our experience this year with the ups and downs of the vaccine manufacturing process has made it clear we need to enhance our country's influenza vaccine manufacturing capability. The Department of Health and Human Services has been working on this since 2005-2006, when it awarded the first six contracts for cell-based flu vaccines. And I cut a ribbon in North Carolina recently in a new cell-based vaccine facility. So those years of preparation and the move beyond the egg-based technology that we've been using for 50 years will actually serve this country very well. President Obama has set aside nearly $500 million in the 2011 budget to upgrade manufacturing of vaccine and other medical countermeasures. You're going to hear from Dr. Nikki Lurie, our Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, who will talk more in detail about this effort later in your conference. Everything we did to fight the 2009-10 H1N1 influenza pandemic was done with an eye toward the future. And what a difference a year does make. At this time last year, we had no idea we'd be confronted with a brand new strain of flu. We didn't know it would spread easily, not primarily affecting seniors like seasonal flu, but primarily among kids and young adults. So today, we're looking back on the most ambitious immunization campaign ever. We've learned important lessons about managing a pandemic and communicating with the public, and about how much we depend on our partners who are working on the front lines. Those of you who worked hard to get kids back for the second dose of H1N1 will be glad to know that next year, the H1N1 strain will be included in the seasonal flu vaccine. So vaccination will be a lot simpler this time around. We've never been in a stronger position to create new and better vaccines, or thanks to the lessons learned from the flu and the opportunities created with health insurance reform and the Recovery Act and other programs, to make more of a difference in public health. So again, I want to thank you. We couldn't have done it without you, and you should be very proud of the work you did. I know that I am. Thanks so much.
See you later.
Thank you so much. See you.